I'm Kevin Kunzman, Managing Editor of medical news site HCP Live. Our team is happy to introduce Heartbeat, a new monthly multimedia series hosted by Dr. Jorge Plutsky, Director of Preventive Cardiology at Harvard Medical School, and Dr. Michael Farku, Director of the Peter Munk Clinical Trials Unit and Vice Chair of Medicine at the University of Toronto. On every episode of Heart Team, Drs. Plutsky and Farku will deliver a deep dive into the unique developments and pertinent stakeholders throughout cardiovascular medicine. The pair will delve into topics on recent news and research, FDA developments, emerging literature, their own case studies, their personal experiences as caregivers and prescribers, and what more is yet to be learned in the rapidly expanding field. Each episode will additionally feature a guest interview with an expert in a unique focus of cardiovascular care. Our audience will have the option to either watch the full episode on our site at hcplive.com or simply listen to the guest interview here on our podcast feed. Today's first episode addresses the growing conversation around simultaneously treating the kidney and the heart, featuring Dr. Matthew Weir, Director of the Division of Nephrology at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Without further ado, enjoy this first episode of Heart Team.
So we're incredibly fortunate to have our good friend and colleague, Dr. Matt Weir from the University of Maryland joining us today. He's, of course, one of the authorities in the field in terms of kidney disease and including its relationship to cardiovascular issues. Matt, thanks for being here. I think one of the things they left off as the most important aspect of your background is the fact that you have 2 degrees. Of which I only share one of them from the University of Virginia. So it's always nice to welcome a fellow Wahoo. I guess the first question is, do you think that Mr. Jefferson would have been a nephrologist or a cardiologist?
Probably a cardiologist. The kidney's a fairly complicated organ. You know, the beauty of cardiovascular medicine is that it's a bit simpler and, I should say, better organized and is much less likely to scare medical students.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we were just talking about the extent to which there's so much attention going on around CKD and cardiovascular disease. It really seems like almost another frontier is opening up. But of course, to people in this area, it's like, well, we've recognized this for quite some time. What's a broad perspective? And we're going to come at you fast and furious with a lot of questions and trying to pick your brain on this really exciting area. What would you say from a broad perspective about the nature of cardiovascular risk among patients with kidney disease? I mean, is that cause, consequence, sort of distinct from some of the other inputs into cardiovascular disease? You know, what's your sense of that?
Yeah, it's definitely a bi-directional relationship. And what I think is underappreciated, and that is that people with kidney disease don't die from kidney disease. They largely die from heart failure. And the relationship of kidney function and incident heart failure and progression of heart failure is very tightly linked. And one can actually use kidney function and even albuminuria as a means of tracking outcomes in patients with heart failure. So I think it's a very important area. I think it's underappreciated. And, you know, as one considers current therapeutic opportunities opening up for kidney disease progression, it's ironic. It's the same pillars of therapeutic opportunity we use for heart failure right now.
Mm-hmm. If you prevent the progression in kidney disease, are you going to prevent progression of cardiovascular disease?
I think realistically, yes. Obviously, being able to prove that in a prospective randomized controlled trial is obviously a very lengthy and expensive effort. But certainly we have evidence in people who already have heart disease, who already have kidney disease, the therapeutic opportunities that alleviate, for example, albuminuria, are associated with less incident heart failure. And so I think it's amazing how tightly these two track with each other.
So Matt, tell us about screening. You know, and we have our cardiology clinics. We were just discussing in the preamble here about how often do we even check for albuminuria in a cardiac clinic versus an internal medicine clinic. Tell us about where we need to be with screening effectively.
Well, I think quite honestly, what is underappreciated, both in the general practice community, but even in the cardiovascular medicine community, is the value of an albumin to creatinine ratio, a spot urine specimen. I remember more than 30 years ago telling Scott Solomon and Mark Pfeffer that they should go back and look at the albuminuria in their patients in their various cardiovascular medicine trials. And sure enough, they continued to publish the data illustrating the relationship and predictive value of albuminuria on outcome. I think it's underappreciated. I think so often in clinical medicine, we get caught up in the hysteria of a new biomarker, a new metabolomic profile, a proteomic profile that's going to tell us who's going to get worse and who's not. But I think if you look back at the available data on estimating GFR and a spot urine albumin to creatinine ratio, there's so much that can be added to our understanding about predicting risk and perhaps even response to therapy.
Right. And so for an internist who may not be doing that, a cardiologist who may not be doing that, would you say that that's warranted in early phases of the disease as opposed to tracking disease in, let's say, patients with hypertension or in all of our patients with diabetes who may or may not have cardiovascular disease?
Well, I mean, let's be fair. Ever since Bill Cannell and his group 50 years ago started analyzing the data from the Framingham Heart Study, it was quite clear that people with protein in the urine had more risk for the development of cardiovascular events. And I think it's quite clear that the presence of increasing amounts of albumin in the urine is a coronary artery disease equivalent. What I think is even more interesting now is the possibility it could also serve as an earlier marker for developing heart failure. And that's why I think there's a lot more interest in appropriately profiling patients and doing these types of very simple markers in our many studies to see how it may pan out as an opportunity to predict risk, but also, perhaps more importantly, response to therapy.
Mm-hmm. And we talk about progression in disease, the SGLT2 inhibitor data has just been very impressive. And it's interesting to see how that's evolving beyond just diabetes and our thinking now about patients who don't have diabetes and the impact of those agents. You know, can you provide an integrated perspective a little bit around SGLT2 inhibitors and how you see that data and its integration into practice?
Well, it's really remarkable serendipity. Let's agree that thanks to Steve Nissen's incorrect interpretations about rosiglitazone many years ago, that in fact, cardiovascular safety studies were required for all medications to be used for the treatment of diabetes. And serendipitously, we discovered that in fact, this therapeutic class provides very important opportunity for heart failure and kidney disease progression, and even all cardiovascular events if some of the studies are appropriately powered with the right kinds of patients. But let's be fair, we still don't understand the mechanism. I think everybody is struggling to understand where the opportunity is. I, for one, do believe that the blood pressure lowering effects are still there and important because, you know, if you look at the totality of evidence of drugs that lower blood pressure, they tend to improve outcomes as opposed to those that tend to raise it that don't. But certainly there's something else, a lot more that we need to learn. And, you know, ultimately, we can't give every drug to every patient. And so what I think the future holds is, shall we say, more precision in choosing appropriate medications for our patients, because it's not just the SGLT2 inhibitors. You know, the GLP-1 receptor agonists also appear to have other effects unrelated to glucose lowering, which improve cardiovascular outcomes. They're also being studied on kidney disease progression. We also have mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists. We have aldosterone synthase inhibitors. We have many, we have Versagut. I mean, we have many, many cardiovascular medicine opportunities in the future, but you just can't give them all to everybody. I mean, basically, that's what we do in heart failure right now, in heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. But I think ultimately that's going to be impractical, both from a pill count, but I think also from a cost standpoint. So ultimately, I think our efforts for improving outcomes will be more precision based so that we can use the right therapies for the right patients. But, you know, in the meantime, we still need to understand the mechanisms. And without some understanding about the mechanisms, we're still going to be just kind of throwing drugs at people and hoping something sticks.
Right.
Matt, tell us about, you know, as a cardiologist, you know, we often face patients with even mild renal insufficiency, when to initiate ACE and RAS inhibition even. And we tend to focus on the creatinine, and when it gets a little bit elevated or even quite elevated, doubling or even a tripling, we just repel. You know, we send them off to nephrology, or sometimes we don't do much. We kind of take the medications away. Tell us about that nuance, because that's part of the precision here, right, is when do these drugs work in the spectrum of renal disease and what your thoughts are.
Well, first of all, let's talk about the cardiorenal relationship. You know, if one really looks at the literature, there are two things that drive or are related to or are associated with increased cardiovascular events, and that's GFR below 45 and increasing amounts of albumin or protein in the urine. It's not a GFR of 60. There are many mature patients who I see, and I don't like to use the word older because I'm one of them now, who will have GFRs in the 50 to 60 range, little or no protein in the urine, no structural abnormalities. And this could be a age-related decline in GFR, which happens in all of us. It's about 0.6 to 1 ml per minute per year after the age of 35. So in a sense, the kidneys are growing older gracefully. On the other hand, once you drop below 45, epidemiologically speaking, the risk markedly increases. And certainly the integration of the amount of albumin or protein in the urine associated with lower GFR magnifies this relationship. So the debate about when to embark on therapy for somebody with a GFR, let's say, of 45, well, hindsight's always 20/20. It's like diabetes. We know prediabetes is associated with increasing cardiovascular disease and incident kidney problems. But, you know, you have to diagnose it sooner to take advantage of what we call primary prevention as opposed to secondary prevention. You know, the devil's in the details, and there's also cost and risk associated with that. But we have many good and safe generic drugs. So in my practice, I always encourage patients with lower GFR to use statins, to use drugs that modify the renin-angiotensin system. These drugs are safe. They are well tolerated for the most part, and they're generic, so it's costly, not costly. Again, we will never, ever have primary prevention data available to us. No one has the resources to truly do that. I mean, people have been struggling to do prediabetes studies for decades. Maybe it'll happen. I just don't know. I mean, it takes a lot of resources. But, you know, you have to weigh the benefit to risk ratio of early start. And I just left a meeting where we're coming up with a document about early start. Where we're going to look at all of the available data for really every area of cardiometabolic renal medicine to address where's the data, what do we have, and where do we go from here. So we're in the process of doing that right now. I'm in charge, not shockingly, of the kidney section. But I think, quite honestly, this is going to be a very individualized area. And I encourage people to adopt appropriate lifestyle measures, which we should always encourage. But I think also, too, there is a place for pharmacological interventions. And as I like to explain to my patients, with increasing age, for all of us, our blood pressure goes up, our LDL cholesterol goes up, we lose glucose tolerance. It is genetically predetermined. It is certainly modified by lifestyle. But at one point in each of our lives, there is, shall we say, a cross point where the benefits of intervening to prevent blood pressure elevation, to prevent loss of glucose tolerance, to prevent loss of beta cells, for example, to prevent LDL increases, probably outweighs the risk of the medication intervention. And, you know, that's where precision medicine is going to come in. Yeah. And I think really what we have right now, though, at least longitudinally, we can track blood pressure, LDL, and fasting glucoses. We can certainly very closely follow family history if it's available. But other than that, I think it's an individual decision.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I think that, you know, the clinical trial data, of course, informs us. And one of the things that I think we're often advocating for is to make sure that we have educated our colleagues, especially in primary care, to not get overwhelmed by the notions of precision and saying, well, I don't know whether to turn left or right in terms of all the new options available to me, but to make sure they're harnessing data that shows an impact that will change outcomes and, you know, even impact mortality. I think that's, you know, I'm interested in your thoughts about this, but I think one of the ways that we intersect practice is when we have some clearly identifiable clinical attributes that a physician can see and say, oh, now I'm going to act on this. You could say, you know, heart attack is one of those. I think in this particular area, one of the ones that I'm beginning to see shape things a little bit is heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, and the fact that we now have an indication for it.
No question.
So a doctor can see that coming back on an echo. Patients, you know, increasingly short of breath and gets an echo, and it turns out that their ejection fraction is completely fine, and the report says, you know, references HFpEF, and that maybe that would trigger saying, okay, I have a drug that's indicated to do that. I mean, you think, and you know, HFpEF is such a fascinating issue. You think that's really going to make a difference, perhaps, in terms of management of these issues related to heart failure and ultimately kidney disease?
Yeah, I do think so. And I'll be honest with you, I think heart failure is going to continue to grow as a more substantial clinical problem, particularly in the setting with more widespread use of lipid-lowering therapies will help attenuate much of the atherosclerotic burden that we see. And I like to teach the medical students that it actually requires more energy for the heart to relax than it does to contract. So the first thing you start to see with a stiff ventricle, I mean, the cause of that is ischemia, and it could very well be microvascular, and it could very well be abnormalities in metabolic milieu with the ventricle that leads to this. But I would say the other thing too that's most apparent to me in clinical medicine is that I can see heart failure with preserved ejection fraction walking through the door. Often it is people who are overweight, people who may have some degree of obstructive sleep apnea. These are people who often have end of the day pedal edema, which resolves at night. It's associated with nocturia. And, you know, if they have some shortness of breath or difficulty with stairs, typically what I do is I talk to my patients, can you climb a flight of stairs without stopping? I think, you know, that to me is my office echo, so to speak. I mean, it's not to say I won't get an echo.
Yeah. That's good.
But, you know, now that we have therapeutic options, of course, we don't know how those options work. That is, obviously, the SGLT2 inhibitor. I still am a fan of MRA. I think they also, too, make a difference, probably because they are probably the best therapies to facilitate nocturnal natriesis with the assumption of recumbency at night, when many of our patients, in a sense, present the excesses of volume in the legs to the central circulation at night. So whether there's a direct effect of MRA in reducing HFpEF or not, I mean, that's the great debate from TopCat results.
Yeah.
But I think they clearly help. And so I use MR blockade in really all of my overweight people who have OSA.
So Matt, given the opportunities and the some of the inertia in initiating therapies, we have SGLT2, finerenone now, exciting evidence emerging for that. Where does that all fit in when we see our patients who have cardiorenal disease? Seems SGLT2 is becoming mainstay. When do we initiate finerenone?
Well, all of these drugs are wonderful. And I'd include the GLP-1RA is coming yeah. down the pipe as well. Sure. But they're all members of what I affectionately call the $500 a month club. and that is wonderful new therapies, which do make a difference. But for many of my patients, they have no access to them. I am bombarded with prior authorizations for using these types of medications. Mm-hmm. And yes, the companies have come up with, you know, gimmicks and, you know, 90 days for $10 and all this kind of stuff, but these are lifetime therapies. And so ultimately the cost will fall to the pharmacy benefit manager and ultimately to the patient. It's frustrating to me to practice in an era when most of my patients don't have access to these drugs, quite honestly. And yes, are we in an improved opportunity time? Yes, we certainly are. For the first time in nephrology in the last 3 to 5 years, when we've had nothing for 20 years, we have now three therapies, the RAS blocker, the MRA, and the SGLT2 inhibitor, as in a sense, our three pillars to utilize for disease progression, which I think is a very exciting time, but it's also a very frustrating time that we can't use them in every patient. You know, a lot of people are debating, which one should you use first? And I don't even think that's a debate anymore. Ideally, in the real world, you'd like to be able to use all of them. And because they all do make a difference, and studies are being done to illustrate this, the secondary analyses of, I guess it's the fidelity analysis of the two big finerenone studies, clearly shows 700-800 people who are on SGLT2 and MR did better. And they even had less problems with potassium. So I think we're there, but we're not ready for prime time quite yet. And I it's frustrating.
So Matt, we always pin this though on the pharmaceutical companies, the cost, but also we have to look at, like in a national health system, like in Canada, where I practice, think about the downstream effects about preventing folks from declining renal function, requiring dialysis, requiring bypass. The cost effectiveness models need to be there. And I think that
make the case.
I think it's an error. It's very much a short-sighted to blame only the pharmaceutical companies who actually invest in the research and development of these companies.
I'm not blaming the companies.
Yeah, I'm talking about in general,
I mean, the companies have to recover their costs for the I mean, how many people have been in SGLT2 trials just in the past 6 or 7 years?
Yeah.
I mean, probably, am I exaggerating if I say 500,000 patients? Probably
I would say under some form of study, you're right.
Yeah. So, I mean, they're recovering their costs. I think really it's the managed care payors that have to come up with an actual value assessment as to, you know, utilization of these new therapies. Yeah. And, you know, the other thing, quite honestly, too, that is difficult to understand, consider all the data with SGLT2 inhibitors when they first came out. It was a diabetes drug, but you could get DKA. Mm-hmm. You could get amputations. You could get fungal infections. You could have bone fractures. I mean, all this bad news came out would scare the average practitioner who is so risk adverse. And yet now suddenly these are not even drugs for diabetes anymore. Forget about it. They're drugs that are for cardiorenal opportunities for our patients to live longer.
Well, let's go to one of those value propositions. We were talking before, it is stunning, the cardiovascular mortality of a patient who's transitioned to renal replacement therapy and, you know, on hemodialysis. I mean, it's just incredible. And of course, there's, you know, be great value to make a dent in that. And, you know, do you think some of these new drugs are going to offer something in that space?
I have no doubt. I have no doubt that they will delay the requirement for dialysis. If anything, what we should be aiming for is to delay kidney disease progression to the point that most of the patients will have the opportunity for a preemptive kidney transplant. I mean, that's really the ultimate opportunity. We should not even be thinking about dialysis. We should be thinking about delaying the need for the development of end-stage renal disease replacement by directing people to a preemptive kidney transplantation.
And what about if you're on dialysis, as so many, you know, people are, you know, in terms of trying to keep them from succumbing to cardiovascular mortality? Do you think there's going to be some hope around these agents or other approaches? I mean, you know, can't we do some?
I honestly don't think so, because the real reason that people on dialysis develop death or go on to death, really? I mean, aside from obviously infection and cancer like everyone else, is really from chronic pressure volume overload due to only the intermittent removal of volume basically every other day. Mm-hmm. And it is the people with the largest interdialytic weight gains that will ultimately develop the progressive heart failure and arrhythmia. And that's why I don't give dialysis patients blood pressure medication. I treat them all with volume reduction. And I try to figure out the best possible way to do that based on the individual patient's needs. This is why, for example, despite all the confounding of the studies that have been done, but people who get dialysis 4 and 5 times a week live longer simply because they have less volume pressure overload challenges during the week. Same thing with peritoneal dialysis. You're able to adjust volume every day. And so there is less of this interdialytic 2, 3, 4 liter increase in volume, which really ultimately wrecks pump function over time.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Yeah.
That's why they die from heart failure and arrhythmia, not atherosclerotic events.
Yeah. Yep.
Terrific. Well, what's the next trial you're tracking? Are you involved with or looking forward to reading about that you think is going to make a difference in this CKD cardiovascular disease arena?
Well, I think some of the more interesting stuff. I mean, I personally am an advisor to, you know, obviously several companies, but most of my funding is all on the from the NIDDK. I mean, we're studying, for example, in the Apollo trial, the APOL1 gene polymorphisms as it affects donated kidneys with the two risk alleles. We're also looking at kidney donors with the two risk alleles to see if it affects outcomes. I mean, those are some of the important things that we're looking at. We also have another study we're about to start looking at people post-acute kidney injury once they're out of the hospital, and to see whether or not an intensive effort to risk modify for them will make a difference in terms of both kidney and cardiovascular events as well as rehospitalization. So those are the kinds of studies that I'm most interested in. And then the other big one that we've had for 15 years is the chronic renal insufficiency cohort study, which is bearing so much fruit in terms of understanding more about the nexus of heart disease and kidney disease and ultimately clinical outcomes, therapeutic opportunities. So that's kind of where I'm focused right now in those areas.
Well, the answers to those questions, along with the insights you've already provided us, is what's going to have us dragging you back for another visit. I kind of had hoped that maybe we'd ask you a question that would be so specific and so hard that you'd go back to that corner in your office and reach deep down into the middle of that stack and say, I've got the answer right here.
I wish I could say that, but I'm old fashioned. You know, some people have totally put everything online. I'm not quite there yet, but maybe someday. You never know.
That's Mark. Okay. Yeah. Well, it certainly equates with your expertise, the fact that you've read all those papers stacked behind you. And it's been great talking with you.
Wonderful, Matt. Really.
We really appreciate it. And
we look really enjoyed this.
To the next time and to crossing paths soon.
Yeah. Well, great seeing you both. Stay well and keep thinking. Nephrocardiac relationship or cardio arena. I'll go back.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Matt.
Take care. Okay.
Have a great day. Take care.
Thanks again for listening in. And if you're interested in more Heart Team video content, such as Dr. Sparku and Plutsky's insight into the cardiology-nephrology collaboration, be sure to visit us at hcplive.com. And be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast as well and give us a 5-star review. For now, I'm Kevin Kunzman with HCP Live. We'll see you again on Heart Teams next month.